Business, Labor, and Consumer Affairs will come to order. Welcome, everyone. It's good to see so many people here interested in this issue. We know that we have strong feelings on both sides, so the purpose of this hearing today is so that everyone will have a chance to speak on this issue. It's invited testimony only. What we've done is we've asked Representative Rosenbaum to make her list of people, and she has an hour of testimony that she has prepared, and we've asked the people who have brought the bill before us to make their list, and they will have an hour of testimony. We will go 30 minutes, 30 minutes, 30 minutes, 30 minutes, try to break it up a little bit so that we can have pro and con. We will be timing this, and so, committee, to be fair, we probably should let our panels testify before we ask questions. In the interest of time, we'll hope that there will be plenty of time for questions. And the people testifying will need to watch the clock and make sure that you're allowing time for you to take questions. Are there any questions from the committee? Okay, we don't want to cut into anybody's time, so we will have the staff read the summary.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, House Bill 2624 deletes the annual adjustment of the minimum wage.
Okay, and we have our first panel will be those presenting the bill. It'll be Representative Girard, Bill Perry, J.L. Wilson, and Rod Quackenbush of Quackenbush Coffee Company.
Thank you, Rob.
Good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair, committee members. I'm State Representative Bill Girard, District 56, which is Klamath Falls, and I am the sponsor of this bill, and I'm here this morning representing the economy in the state of Oregon, and that is the main reason that I am part of this bill, is the fact that I believe we have to do some things, some very hard things, to get the economy of our state back in order. As a small businessman for over 40 years where I've owned my own business, I know that most small businesses have two kinds of expenses, those that are flexible, those that are inflexible. And that when the going gets rough, those inflexible expenses do not move. Your power bills, your inventory bills, etc. What can move, and usually what gets targeted first, is salaries and the number of people you have working. I'm speaking for Eastern Oregon. It was interesting this morning. I went into a restaurant, and there was a long line of people here in Salem at that particular restaurant. I could bet you I could go to a restaurant in my district in Klamath Falls, and there would be no lines. And that's part of the difference between the eastern side of the state and the western side of the state. We need to create jobs, and we need to do that desperately, and we need to do everything we can for business to help create those jobs. That's why I'm here. Thank you.
For the record, Chair Close, members of the committee, my name is Bill Perry. I'm from the Oregon Restaurant Association. We represent a little over 3,000 food and beverage establishments in the state. As you see, I handed out a packet, and behind my testimony there's a glossary of additional items, and the two I want to bring to bear first is the groups of support. There are going to be far more groups that are not going to be testifying today because they wanted to give a chance to citizens, so they wanted their name put in. The other one will be a graph that I will refer to in the middle of my testimony, so if you could have it handy, I would appreciate it. First of all, 2624 leaves 690 as Measure 25 passed, and only deals with the indexing measure, which, as we look at states that have it indexing from a business standpoint, that seems to be the most damaging from our small employers and employees. We did a study after the last minimum wage increase, and what it showed was the first minimum wage increase right after the vote had some hour reduction and job loss, but as the second and third tier under the old Measure 36 kicked in, the hour reduction actually increased. And that is a special concern to us because Measure 25 makes that constant. It's not going to give business a chance to catch up. Higher minimum wage affects low wage earners in three different ways. First of all, the hour reduction, which I just talked about. The second one is with insurance premiums and benefit costs going up, it's usually the first thing to go. And those lower wage earners can't afford benefit plans because they're more expensive as individuals than I as an employer could get them in group plans. The third thing is one of the first things to go is training costs. And by a short-term wage increase, if I cut out a training cost, it cuts the ability of the employee to have a long-term earning potential. Offering a younger person a job and giving them training up front is going to be more value to them early on than maybe a 40-cent or a 20-cent wage increase. Oregon's economy is struggling. Obviously, we just took over the highest unemployment rate in the country from Washington. We're at 7.5%. When Measure 36 was introduced, we were at 4% below the national average. By the time a year or two after of its full implementation, we had taken the lead on unemployment. Washington, when their indexing passed, soon took the lead back from us, but now we have regained the lead. In my testimony, it talks about population growth versus job growth in both Oregon and Washington. Both Oregon and Washington last year, before Measure 26, had a little more than 1% population growth. The employment growth in Oregon almost matched it at 1.2%. The employment growth in Washington was 0.2, which is one-fifth of the population growth. So we had equal, they had one-fifth, and they're 4 years into their indexing measure. The graph that I spoke about earlier, it's been said that the restaurant industry in Oregon is growing. We are fortunate from the standpoint of the mountain states are the highest growing restaurant population in the country. They're at 6.6% when you average all the states. Pacific Coast is next behind it at 6.2%. Those are the two fastest growing regions. But when you look at the graph, I've broken each state down by the way it grows. Nevada is the highest. Oregon, Alaska, and Washington are the lowest, the three states with the CPI, and they're almost in exact order of the way they rank. Now remember, these statistics were taken before Measure 25 passed, so this was before the 690. When you look at the column next to them, they're almost in exactly the same order as the minimum wage rates in those states. The lowest minimum wage has the highest growth, and the highest minimum wage has the lowest growth. Then you take the next step and look at unemployment rates, they're almost equal. The ones with the lowest minimum wage has the lowest unemployment rate, and the one with the highest minimum wage has the highest unemployment rate. Hunger and poverty rates. This measure has been talked about as a way to help hunger and poverty in the state of Oregon. Oregon's been leading the country in hunger ever since shortly after Measure 36 passed. So having a high minimum wage is no correlation to hunger rates. Washington also had the fastest growing poverty rate of any other state when the first 4 years of their indexing measure. In conclusion, I would like to say we're going to hear a lot of emotional pleas today about people that want to increase the minimum wage to help small businesses and Oregon's neediest family. However, the statistics, real-life examples, and the stories you're going to hear from business shows that even though the stories are compelling and we need to do something about them, raising the minimum wage is not the solution. It has not proven to be the solution. I would like to close with a quote, a study that just came out in Washington done by Ohio University since Measure 25 passed, so we didn't have it during the campaign, was a quote from the Better Study from Ohio says, and I quote, "Washington minimum wage then has failed in its primary objective. Rather than a relatively cheap way to alleviate poverty, the law has cruelly and capriciously brought about job and income loss to workers and small entrepreneurs. Had the voters known this would happen, it is difficult to believe that they would endorse the well-intended but truly economically destructive mandate." With that, I'll pass it on to Rob. Thank you.
Hi, Madam Chair, Committee. My name is Rob Quackenbush. I own three restaurants or coffee shops in Klamath Falls, Oregon. We feel like the impact of Measure 25 is devastating, especially in our area. As Mr. Perry has mentioned, historically these minimum wage, and we've seen it in our business, has caused business failures, excuse me, and higher unemployment, especially in our area down there. In our business, when the minimum wage has risen, we have little choice but to choose between our cost of goods, our what we pay our employees, and there's a balance there that we have to maintain. A percentage of cost of that employee is important to our business to stay in business. Last year, our payroll is approximately 36,158 hours. Looking at the first 2 months of this year after the January 1st increase, we are budgeting for 33,348 hours. That's a decrease of 28,810 hours. Approximately a full-time person. In our case, usually it's will be probably three part-time people. Jason Federico from business manager Applegate Restaurants. I talked to him the other day. They operate Burger King franchise in Southern Oregon. They're looking at a 7-10% decrease in those hours at their restaurants to compensate for the higher minimum wage. As the CPI kicks in, they're looking at a real tough situation because they've got to deal with national pricing. We look at pricing as a problem because we have a limit to what people will pay for our products, so we can't continue to raise our prices. It has something that we have looked at. We've got to balance that between pricing increases and reduction in payroll. Also, I want to represent myself as a board member of the Klamath Lake Food Bank in Klamath Falls, a great organization. Helps a lot of people. Our director down there, Nikki Sampson, has told me that they've had 18 families that have come in and required services from them. Now, that doesn't sound like a lot, but if you understand the food bank, we're not required to ask why you have an income problem. You can volunteer that information. So we feel like it might be a tip of an iceberg to have 18 people volunteer that information that they've been affected by their loss of income due to minimum wage increases. As we have had laid people off of our shop, that happens at other restaurants and other businesses in Klamath Falls. Also, we have a problem with what I would call compression upwards. We have our management team that is getting closer and closer to the minimum wage. Where do we balance that out? Do we lay them off, hire more minimum wage people, or do we increase their wages to keep them? We don't want to lose their talents, but as they come to me and say, you know, minimum wage went up 40 cents, where do we go? We've got to look at that and decide where we're going to make our cuts. When we look at our profit, we spend 17% on fixed cost, rent, lights, etc. We spend approximately 38% on cost of goods, purchasing the materials we resell, and 36% on our payroll. That leaves 7% for us, taxes, capital improvements, increasing our business, advertising to build our business. If you look at a dollar bill, when every dollar comes in, 38 cents goes to the cost of the goods, 36 to payroll, 17 to paying the light bill. Where do we adjust to make this increase? And especially at a time when we don't see a end to this, it is an ongoing yearly increase in our cost to operate our business. The other problem that we see is, and it's kind of an emotional thing to us, is hiring entry-level people. Something that we've done in the past, we've been in business for about 7 years, and we took great pride into hiring high school kids, a lot of college kids, single moms, first-time job people. But when they come in, high school kid comes in, we very seldom hire them, and almost never if they haven't had a job previously. We can't afford to train them to work, plus train them to make our product at this kind of a wage increase. We've had a lot of kids come through our shop. We've had them for many years. We follow their careers. They start out working for us, go to OIT, earn a living. A lot of them are single family moms. Some of them are kids that have to work to make an education. we train them to work, we get them through that, and they move on into better jobs. Those are the people that pay the taxes. That's the jobs that give to charities, and they buy the consumer's products in Oregon that drive this economy. I think I just want to conclude with our concerns are for the health of small businesses because it's a big part of Oregon economy. Thank you.
Thank you very much. J.L. Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm J.L. Wilson. I represent just over 12,000 employers who are members of the NFIB here in Oregon. House Bill 2624 is especially pertinent now that we've reassumed the highest unemployment rate in the country. And from our perspective, it's absolutely irrefutable. The highest minimum wage states in the country, right here on the West Coast, have the highest unemployment rates. And I think it's more than coincidence. From our association standpoint, I think we'd like for the legislature to kind of draw a line and say, from this point forward, there's not a single job or a single business that we take for granted in this state anymore, because we're too far in the depths to conclude otherwise. Now, the fact is the increased minimum wage has not created a single job in this state. In fact, we've gone just the opposite direction. And furthermore, the indexing of the minimum wage will not create a single job in this state. In fact, the job losses represented in this room alone, with a testimony that will follow me, should be more than anybody's willing to accept, especially in light of where we are. And it's attributable to minimum wage. Now, job creation is where we need to be. Job creation policies are what we need to enact. But an index minimum wage is totally, totally incongruent with where we need to go as a state to pick ourselves up. Now, there are just a couple points I want to make about the minimum wage and how business adapts. Business doesn't stay static in the face of mandated wage increases. I don't think anybody in this room really believes that a business stays static in light of wage increases or other mandated cost increases. You've got to understand that there is a survival mentality in the small business community right now of just trying to stay afloat. That's how things are. And in the face of mandated cost increases, you can do a couple things. You can increase your sales, and part of that is contingent upon whether people have money to spend or not, which apparently they don't. Or it depends on trading in less productive employees for more productive employees if you can find them. You can raise prices, but for a small business, why would you raise a price if Walmart already sells the same item for 10% less down the street? It's not an option. Or you can cut, as Representative Girard said, those flexible costs, which are invariably costs associated with labor. And that's where you go. As the testimony that preceded me indicates, that's where you go. So who does the minimum wage help in light of this? I'm really afraid that we're going to relegate Oregon to permanent second-class status with these types of minimum wage increases that are automatic. Because you're looking at impacting businesses with payroll costs that are associated with economic activity in Portland, in the metro area, something that rural businesses have no part of, no say in, and furthermore, don't even really share the economic benefits of, but you're asking them to pay costs associated with a metro economy. And I'm not sure that that's fair. Third, we're really acting as though our businesses compete only amongst themselves here in this state, when the facts are, the reality of today's marketplace is that it's broadening. It's national in scope. It's international in scope. So it seems to me that we're throwing up our hands on entire sectors of our economy that have to compete nationally and internationally. So how does Oregon prosper when our companies cease to be competitive in a national or international marketplace? And I think primarily of a sector that we're still largely dependent on, which is agriculture. Are we making a judgment that these are companies and jobs not worth having in our state? I don't think so. At least I hope that's not a judgment that we're making. And finally, I'd like to point out, it wasn't too long ago when we thought we were immune to the business cycle. We thought we were immune to economic recession, any fluctuations in the economy. But I think our arrogance has now subsided. And we are faced with the reality that, yes, the business cycle still applies, recessions still happen. And by extension, what are we going to do When the inflation rate, which fortunately we've been able to hold down, gets to 6, 8, 10%, God forbid, and we still have this policy in place, what are we going to do when the job losses ensue and we don't have any economic growth to show for it? Are we still going to latch on to this policy because it's a great idea? You know, I would just say we are not immune to those economic circumstances that previously we thought we might have been immune to. To the extent that this measure was sold to the business community as providing some stability, consistency, and predictability in rates, the members of NFIB, 93% of whom said, "We don't buy it. This is a constant impediment to our ability to grow and expand our businesses." And I guess I would hope that this is one instance in which you might rely on the sentiment of people who are expected to create jobs, because they're the very same folks who are going to get us out of this mess. Finally, I guess I'd just like to wrap up by saying a jobless recovery, or worse yet, a climbing unemployment rate, I don't think is acceptable to anybody in this room. Nobody wants to see it. But you, unlike most people in the state, really have the ability to turn things around. You do. And if a minimum wage hike created jobs or the indexing created jobs, that'd be one thing, but it doesn't. It doesn't create one job. And we really don't have the luxury of a booming economy to mask the lost opportunities that we did in the late 90s. And the job losses are right out there in plain sight. They're there for everybody to see. Our unemployment rate reflects it. To wrap up with what I opened with, the highest unemployment rates coincide with the highest minimum wage rates, which are right here in the Northwest. And I would suggest that it's more than coincidence, but I would also suggest that it's not too late to stop and give ourselves the opportunity for an unencumbered shot at recovery. That's the NFIB's take on the measure, and I appreciate your listening here.
Thank you very much. Your second panel...
How many minutes?
We have 10 minutes. So I think we'll go to the second panel. And I'll call Tony Raffalo and Neil Reddy. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning. Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Anil Reddy, and I'm the Regional Key Initiatives Manager for Jack in the Box Restaurants. I cover the states of Oregon, southwestern Washington, and Idaho. And I also serve on the Board of Directors for the Oregon Restaurant Association. And first of all, once again, thank you for allowing me the opportunity to be here today. Prior to 1996, we in Jack in the Box had three restaurants in this market area, which is the state of Oregon. In the succeeding years, we have aggressively added 35 more restaurants in the state of Oregon. We want to continue this growth, but given the changes in the cost of doing business directly and indirectly, it's becoming hard. Due to increasing labor costs, the cost of doing business has increased and the bottom line is getting alarmingly tight. This is creating a concern for us and it's making it difficult to grow. Due to the recent minimum wage increase, the area of opportunity lies in providing ways and means to create employment and not add to the existing unemployment, which, by the way, is 7.5%. That has risen from 7.3% in December. The national unemployment rate is sitting at 5.8%. We are even behind California, which is trending at 6.7%, and that's where you hear about more than too often layoffs and the number of layoffs which take place and collapsing families and businesses. The effect of employment due to minimum wage could be better illustrated as follows. Restaurants operate on a fixed labor percent. You know, no matter the trends of business, that's difficult to change. The restaurant business is a penny business. You're not looking at dollars for profits. On every dollar, it's just basically bottom line rolls down to the 6 or 7 cents which is left to take care of the capital expenditures and profitability. And this computed to dollars, and when you take a look at it, on an average restaurant in the Jack in the Box system, here in the state of Oregon provides close to around about 650 labor hours during a week for production labor. And due to the recent increases from 650 to 690, we have seen an average drop of 18.9 hours. The range is anywhere from 13 hours to 30 hours, depending on the volume of the restaurant. And this is, in fact, not just necessarily looking at the minimum wage employee from 650 to 690. There are compressions in place. You know, we set wage guidelines for each layer of employees. We have members who are the beginning of management, who are the starting levels of management. We start them off a dollar above the minimum wage. And we do have starting points, which are minimum wage. And when we see those compressions grow, you're looking at an impact of approximately an average of 21 cents per employee in the restaurant. And we take great pride. I mean, we take great pride in being able to hire those high schoolers. I mean, trying to get into the realm of responsibility. And we take great pride in training them to enter into the world of responsibility. But given the rate increases, given the wage increases, and given the drop in the number of hours, we tend to provide those hours to our full-time employees. Because the cost of training these people, cost of payroll costs, cost of insurance for minors, is astronomical. And when you add it to the minimum wage, it just negates the reason to train these people. The effect would also be on the consumers who seek great customer service and would have compromised due to the hurried workforce. And you could see for yourselves, you go into restaurants, a year ago you'd have been helped by seven people there. But with this recent effect, you would probably see one person less on the floor. And guess what? The scope of work has not reduced. It's just being done by less people. And that creates a hurried environment. People are stressed. We tend to roll into high turnover because they just don't want to do it anymore. And this creates, you know, disability and all kinds of workplace injuries, not just necessarily due to the physical environment, but due to the social environment in the restaurants. And this is what causes it.
Excuse me, we have 5 minutes left for this panel.
Okay. I want to close this one up in terms of saying if this trend is to continue, there could be a loss of business from the state, and the burden of covering the costs due to the losses would fall upon the businesses that have ownership in the state. And I really want to emphasize is to watch the negative impact because it could have a sustaining impact on the state. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Reddy.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tony Ruffalo. I'm a professor at Portland State University. I've been asked by the Oregon Restaurant Association to review the economic analyses of the effect of the minimum wage. To be relatively brief, the economic analyses are basically all over the place. You can find good analyses that purport to find no impact of the minimum wage on employment. You can find other good analyses that claim that minimum wages cause up to a 1% reduction in employment. I think just briefly, I'd like to discuss why we see such differences. Basically, the economic analysis of the minimum wage argues that it will have a disincentive effect. In other words, the higher price will cause a reduction in employment or the demand for employees, but it depends on what the impact of the wage is relative to the going market wage. And we find that, in fact, the impact of the minimum wage relative to the market wage varies for a large number of reasons. For some of the things that have been talked about anecdotally here, things like fringe benefits, number of hours, and so on, can be adjusted to mitigate the impact of a higher minimum wage. We also find substantial differences in the impact of minimum wage based upon geography. The average wages in the Portland metropolitan area are typically well above the average wages in the rural areas, and so we would expect that the impact of the minimum wage would be much higher. And in fact, during the boom period, the recent boom periods, it's quite possible that the market wages were above the minimum wages in the Portland metropolitan area, and that at least partly explains some of the differences that we observe between the rural and the urban areas and the unemployment rates. We also find that there are changes over time. Wages go up and the minimum wage may be constant. So there are many reasons why there are difficulties in discerning the impact of the minimum wage and why we get such broad estimates of what the impact is. Basically, In reviewing the studies, as I mentioned earlier, the ranges that you see are something like from zero up to a full percentage point reduction in employment associated with minimum wages. One study summarized the effect of the minimum wage by looking at all the 40 states, the 50 states and the District of Columbia, and taking the unemployment rates for the districts that had a minimum wage above the federal minimum wage and comparing it to the districts that had minimum wage at the federal minimum. And basically what they found was that the average is 0.5% higher unemployment rate in the states that had states and jurisdictions that had a minimum wage above the federal minimum. This probably coincidentally falls about the middle of the range of the empirical studies, but you know, without any certainty, this is probably your best estimate of what the overall impact of the minimum wage is. That it's about 0.5% impact on the number of jobs. Now that's not a huge number, and there's a great deal of uncertainty, and it's going to vary with the economic conditions. But that's still 7,000 or 8,000 jobs that you're talking about that are probably impacted by the minimum wage. The other question I was asked to address is who benefits and how does the economic analysis deal with this. Basically, if you look at the minimum wage earners, as you've probably heard, many of them are definitely not from poverty families. One study found that more than half of the minimum wage earners were from families that had an income above median income, and that relatively few of the minimum wage earners are lower income. That the net effect that you're having is that you are raising income for some people, and that there is a real trade-off in that some people are not going to find jobs or are going to have longer periods of unemployment while they're looking for jobs. And the other thing that I think it's important to understand is that when there's an excess supply of labor, employers are going to be more selective about who they are going to hire. And in general, that means that the people who are least qualified, the ones with the worst employment records, with potential problems coming off of drug treatments or whatever, are going to find it even more difficult to find jobs. So it's not an impact that is spread evenly amongst the population. In fact, it may be counterproductive if your intent is to help low-income families. Basically, the way economic analysis views it, the minimum wage can be viewed as a tax on business that is arbitrarily distributed to people based upon their work experiences. You have much better ways of addressing low-income and poverty, such as the earned income tax credit. And again, basically, there's no certainty, but I think that there is definitely a trade-off. The magnitude of that trade-off is the only real uncertainty.
Thank you, Mr. Raffalo. I appreciate it. Thank you, panel. We are out of time, so I'm sorry, committee, we don't have time for questions, but we will provide you with the list of testifiers and phone numbers so that you can call people and ask the questions. Okay, our next panel is Representative Diane Rosenbaum, Commissioner Dan Gardner, Tim Nesbitt, and if we can have the other members, we only have the three chairs, but if the other members can be close by, we will call Cassandra and Jacqueline, Ramon, Jose, and Hector as we have chairs. Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I am Diane Rosenbaum. As you all know, I am State Representative for District 42, but also appearing today in my capacity as having served as Chief Petitioner for Ballot Measure 25 in the last election. On November 5th, voters approved Ballot Measure 25, and what it did was raise Oregon's minimum wage to $6.90 an hour and provide for annual cost of living increases. The result was in January of this year, the measure took effect and gave the first increase in 4 years to approximately 150,000 hardworking Oregonians. These are people who were either working at minimum wage or below the level of $6.90 an hour. Today, barely 2 months after this measure took effect, this committee is being asked to repeal the annual increases based on the cost of living. This is not only an affront to the electorate who just democratically approved this in the election, but even more so, it would drive Oregon's low-wage workers and their families further into poverty, even as they're struggling to put food on the table and a roof over their heads. And I appreciated the comments of the previous panel that many costs are going up, energy, medicine, health insurance, food. those can't be controlled by the people that are working at minimum wage either. And their wages, if they do not go up, have no ability, no elasticity to allow them to purchase utilities, heat, food, housing, all those things that are going up for all of us. So that is why there needs to be a cost of living. And who are Oregon's minimum wage workers? Well, the stereotype that you sometimes hear of a teenager working for a little extra pocket money to buy CDs or clothes is far from the reality. Minimum wage workers are overwhelmingly adult. 73% of them are over the age of 20. The vast majority are female. In fact, 65% of them are women. And many of them are supporting not just themselves, but at least one dependent. One out of four is a single parent supporting at least one child. And they're doing some of the hardest, most backbreaking, and most important jobs that we have in society. You know, we hear a lot about restaurant workers and retail workers, but minimum wage workers also are the people that take care of our elders in nursing homes, take care of our kids in child care centers, and the people who grow our food. And you'll hear from some of these workers today. The high rate of hunger and poverty in Oregon has been well publicized of late, but I just wanted to point out a couple of things that have come to light recently. The Oregon Progress Board just produced their 2003 Oregon Benchmarks study, and what it shows is that there's a poverty rate in Oregon overall of 12% of all Oregonians. And in the 1990s, even in those boom economic times, that rate has held steady. It has not gone down. And among children, things are even worse. We have actually 16% of the kids in this state living in poverty. And in terms of hunger, it's been well publicized that we lead the nation in terms of the rate of hunger. We have a rate that's approximately twice what the national average is. And these are the problems that voters were trying to address by approving a modest increase in the minimum wage. I want to also just address the fact that the minimum wage, which has just gone up 40 cents an hour, does not even catch up with what the rate of inflation had been in the 4 years since the last time it went up. According to the Employment Department, that rate of inflation was 8.8%, and this 40 cent an hour increase in the minimum wage was just a 6% increase. So I want to suggest to you that we have a better way of doing it than what we've done in the past, which is to freeze the minimum wage for years at a time and then have it go up, not like this proposal. The way it's gone up in the past is in three jumps over a three-year period in approximately 50 cent increases. And to tie it to the cost of living, to have it go up in much smaller but regular amounts, I believe will be much easier for businesses, but will ensure that we don't have a minimum wage that continues to fall behind and then has to go up in larger amounts in order to begin to keep up with the cost of living. The economic stimulus effect of a raise in wages for the lowest paid workers is immediate and it is local. These are not people who are salting their money away in savings accounts or 401ks or the stock market. Not that anybody much is doing that these days, but these are people that are spending every dime they make just to buy shoes for their kids, to pay their heat bills, to buy food, and all the other basic necessities. And if we repeal this cost of living increase, that is money that will be drained directly out of those local businesses. I'm going to close by quoting from some testimony from a couple of restaurant owners. These are Sean Brown and John Doyle. They're co-owners of a three restaurants, actually, called No Fish, Go Fish in the Portland area. They say they couldn't be here today because they're working in their restaurants. Thank you for the opportunity to communicate our opposition to House Bill 2624. As restaurant owners, you might expect us to oppose indexing Oregon's minimum wage, but we support the inflation adjustment, and we want to tell you why. It's simple. No one who works full-time should have to live in poverty. In our restaurant, we employ 7 wait staff. They're all adults using the wages they earn to support their families. Every day, we see how tough it is for them to make it. The cost of living keeps increasing, but in many restaurants, the wages haven't kept up. In our restaurant, we've paid above the minimum wage for 2 years. Our business has not suffered because of increased overhead. Instead, we have employees who stay longer, reducing our training costs. And we have happier employees who give better service to our customers. It's a win-win for all of us. So in closing, I would just ask you to remember that voters just approved this barely 2 months ago. It took effect. There's been no experience to show that it won't work, as proponents are saying it will. And indeed, when voters spoke, they were saying that no one who works full-time should have to live in poverty. I would ask you to respect the choice that voters made and to reject this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dan Gardner, Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries. We do have some written testimony before you outlining part of the minimum wage increase and the duties of the Bureau as far as setting the making the adjustments to the CPI on an annual basis. Also included in the testimony are some charts and an explanation of exactly what CPI and how it works. Some of the arguments that have been made say that this is an urban consumer price index increase. This does actually cover about 85% of the country's population within that CPI that's set out in the measure. There's also a couple of other charts stating what other minimum wages are across the country. We are tied for the third highest minimum wage in the nation. There are two other states that also have consumer price index, the state of Washington and that of Alaska. Washington only implemented its first CPI increase in January of this year of 11 cents an hour. Let me make it really clear for the record, by the way, that the Bureau is very neutral on this. However, as a statewide elected official and one of the chief petitioners for the minimum wage initiative, I personally am not. So, the other chart you might see here is on the back side of one of your pages, which shows that in 1997 we had started implementing the consumer price index instead of the 3.50 an hour jumps in that particular initiative passed in 1996 and the 40-cent jump in the last initiative passed just this last November, and instead use the consumer price index, the minimum wage in this state at the moment would be $6.20 an hour instead of $6.90 an hour as it is. And what that tells us is that these are, in fact, small, slow, steady increases. The state of Washington just implemented their first CPI increase, which was 11 cents an hour. We're talking about $4.40 an hour, or $4.40 a week on a person who works a 40-hour paycheck. These are not huge, massive increases, but to those minimum wage workers, that may mean the difference of whether they can buy their children another pair of shoes for school this year or not. I think that all of the arguments you heard from the proponents of the bill are the same arguments that they made in the during the election this last November, when the proponents of the ballot measure were outspent 2-1. There is no conclusive proof that there is a direct correlation between unemployment and increases in the minimum wage. The state of Washington and the state of Oregon, their highest losses in unemployment have been in that of high tech. And I believe that these small, slow, steady increases give certainty to employers and to employees. And that gives them a steady, it gives the employees the belief that they're going to have a small increase. It gives the employers the predictability of that increase. And I believe that this is just recently passed by the voters. The same arguments were made at the ballot box. I think that the proponents of this bill should take it back to the voters if they believe they can do it there rather than seek relief here, because the effort in putting CPI into that initiative was really to take minimum wage out of the political arena, where to keep constantly going to the ballot every single cycle. And I think the people of the state of Oregon saw that, realize it, and that's why the initiative was passed. And I would certainly hope that this committee nor this legislature would be willing to change the will of the voters.
Thank you.
Chair Close, members of the committee, I'm Tim Nesbitt, president of the Oregon AFL-CIO. When it comes to fighting poverty, overcoming hunger, promoting work, and sustaining families, there's no law or policy more important to our state than the one that sets our minimum wage. This is the standard we've established to make sure that workers aren't forced to live in poverty, that working for a living means just that, working for a living, not working for, to go hungry or homeless or deeper in debt. As FDR said when he signed the first minimum wage law, the Fair Labor Standards Act, 65 years ago,
The minimum wage is meant, quote, to end starvation wages, unquote. Amazingly, that purpose remains compelling today in a state where we have been shamed by the highest hunger rate in the nation and where the national minimum wage has become a prescription for poverty. The minimum wage approved by Oregon voters just 4 months ago sets our standard as low as we can go and still meet the goal of working for a living. $6.90 an hour is right at the poverty level for a full-time worker with two dependents. It is rightly called a minimum wage, the bare minimum needed to support a family. This is not a standard we can afford to lower over time. Without cost of living adjustments, the minimum wage will quickly become, again, a poverty wage. As the voters have told us, this is not acceptable. A full-time worker should not have to live in poverty. Bill Perry testified that he thinks raising the minimum wage may not be the solution to hunger and poverty, but certainly jobs that don't pay enough to live on are no better solution. But the reasons for maintaining a fair minimum wage go beyond preventing poverty. It's good for workers and their families at and above the minimum wage. It's a tonic for our economy because it boosts consumer spending. And it's fair because in today's economy, it has helped to capture a portion of the productivity gains experienced in all of our workplaces and direct a modest portion of those gains to the workers who contribute to our economic success. Even in today's economy, workers are working harder and smarter and better than before. The Federal Reserve Bank of New York reported recently that productivity growth in the U.S. in 2002 was at its highest level in almost 30 years. Also, the minimum wage does more than set a bottom-rung standard. Because the increases in 97-99 boosted pay for one out of seven jobs in our economy, and that's documented in the attached chart to my testimony. And because it had that effect, it also cushioned the fall for workers who were laid off from higher-paying jobs and forced into lower-paying jobs during the current recession. If you allow inflation to erode the minimum wage over time, you not only force our lowest-paid workers into poverty, you drive down standards for workers above them as well. Yes, these are tough times. Businesses are under pressure. Unemployment is high. But ironically, job growth continues strongest in our lowest paid jobs. Farmers still complain about the difficulty of finding enough workers. And studies show that the cost of doing business in Oregon, most recently the Progress Board study released last Friday, is lower than in most other states, in part because our tax burden on business is the lowest in the West. When a business owner sits down to draft a business plan, he or she factors in the cost of rent and equipment, water and electricity, liability insurance and property taxes, and the cost of employing workers. At one time or another, every business owner makes that calculation. But the public policy of this state says that when you make that calculation, do not assume that you can pay a poverty wage, because that's not acceptable. Not now, not next year, not the year after. Just as you have to pay your rent and your electricity, you should have to pay a minimum wage that doesn't force a worker to live in poverty. And by the way, a 2 or 3% increase in the minimum wage is going to be a lot more manageable than a 30 or 40% increase in the cost of electricity. And just, again, to respond to the accusations of job loss due to the minimum wage, be careful as you review the data. We have data showing that we've lost over... of foreign trade. We've lost many, many more jobs in the last couple of years because of the spike in energy costs. And where do those dollars go? Overseas or to Houston? So at least the increase in the minimum wage means those dollars come right back into our local economy, because our lowest paid workers spend their paychecks every day in the local communities and local retail establishments, including our restaurants. A few words on the CPI formula we measure 25. This formula is based on the U.S. City Average Consumer Price Index for all urban consumers. We chose this formula because it covers the largest percentage of the population in the U.S., 87%. You can't find a formula that covers more workers in the U.S. and more families. And we chose the U.S. index rather than the Portland index because it is less volatile and more representative of less populated areas. This is a formula used in current law in Oregon to index our income tax brackets, and the formula you chose to index for pharmacy fees under the Senior Prescription Drug Assistance Program.
If it's good enough for us as taxpayers and good enough for us as consumers, it should be good enough for us as workers, especially when its purpose is to keep workers from falling into poverty. I want to point out that in the last session, the last regular session of the legislature, you passed a law, HB 2744, advocated by some of the same people who testified before me this morning, that banned minimum wage laws at the local level on the theory that we should have one minimum wage that should be good enough for all Oregonians. Well, the voters have spoken again on that matter. We've reset the minimum wage back to that modest level we had in 1999. It applies to all workers statewide. It reaffirms the principle that every job should pay enough to keep a worker out of poverty. And we don't have to come back to you for 10 or 15 cent increases because the voters have said they want that taken care of by a formula that reflects the cost of living. We now have a minimum wage that keeps workers out of poverty, barely, and a formula to make sure they don't fall back into poverty in the future. All you have to do is leave it alone, and we'll keep what the voters have said they want. A minimum wage that at the very least means no worker will be left behind when it comes to feeding and supporting a family. With HB 2624, the proponents are asking for permission to pay a poverty wage. You should respond as the voters responded. Permission denied.
Thank you very much. We will call Cassandra Garrison, Jacqueline Snyder, Tyra Lynn. Okay, we have 13 minutes, and we have six people to testify, so I'd suggest about 2 minutes apiece. Do we have one more coming, or we can call up Ramon if you're missing a person. Ramon Ramirez? Welcome.
Good morning. My name is Cassandra Garrison. I'm a policy advocate for the Oregon Food Bank. I also run an independent consulting business, and I work with nonprofits across the state. I provide community education and outreach, and I do focus groups with low-income families. I'm here representing the Oregon Food Bank today. I wanted to explain that the Oregon Food Bank's mission is to end hunger and its root causes. We are a network of local member agencies that have served over 720,000 unduplicated recipients within the last year. I have handed to you two documents. One is our focus group report. This was the report that I worked on last year where I traveled statewide and talked to 81 participants of the Oregon Food Bank system. And what I really would like to point out to you in this report is we did go to rural Oregon and we did talk to people who were receiving low-income wages and receiving food boxes within our system. Some of the things that they spoke about were the issues of high housing costs, high food costs, and low income, but also the issue of high prescription drugs and that transportation costs were of a big issue. This was just last year that we did, and we asked them, you know, to address issues around hunger and health care, employment, and housing, and their advice. So I wanted you to see what was happening across the state. I am a policy advocate for the Oregon Food Bank, and I want to address that we're all struggling. I can thoroughly understand the issue of the Restaurant Association and agribusiness, but our agency here at the Oregon Food Bank has been hit very hard. We're number one in the nation with the most unemployed people, but we're also number one in the nation with the most hungriest people in the nation. We were number one in hunger before we ever became the most unemployed state in the nation. So I just wanted to address that. What I found last year when I was traveling the state was that families were working 40 hours plus. They were carrying two jobs. We have seen the face of poverty change from a single parent with one or two children to parents working full-time jobs, two minimum wage jobs, two parents in the household working full-time, not being able to make ends meet. The jobs that people were working were low wage. service sector jobs and seasonal employment, but yet they were still receiving food stamps, low-income energy assistance, Oregon Health Plan, employment-related daycare subsidized by the state. So even though they were working full-time, they were being subsidized by state and federal programs. Some of the things that I wanted to talk to you about on this sheet of paper is that in the last 7 years, we've seen our client base double. And in rural Oregon, that was even more apparent, that we saw more families coming in to get food. Another thing that I wanted to point out was really on the back, to talk about the demographics of who was coming to the Oregon Food Bank. I consider our agency a barometer of what's happening in this state. We were seeing that the largest two-parent families was still the group that were coming. 60% of these people were two-parent families working full-time. 40% of those were children receiving this emergency food. Right here, and here it says 47% of the respondents' households spent more than 50% of their income on housing. And that 22% spent 75% of their income on housing. With a current minimum wage of two parents working $6.50 an hour, we saw that those parents had to work two jobs. What if you were a single mother? So what we really were seeing is how hard that people were working and they weren't making ends meet. Some of the other things that I wanted to point out is the lack of health insurance. That 42% of those households had working members, but only 26% of those households had health insurance. And we're talking about children. 22% of the children that were within our system of the Oregon Food Bank had no coverage at all. So
what? 8 minutes.
Okay. What I wanted to explain is that, you know, we've seen ever increasing issues around the Oregon Food Bank with the people who are coming to the food bank about fixed cost. You know, they have fixed costs with electric and transportation and rent and child care and medical coverage and their taxes. But the issue is that there's no bill collector for food. So what they were doing is they were coming to the food bank to offset the amount of money that they weren't making. It's not true that this will not create a single job, this incremental increase. It will not create a single job. But what it will do is stabilize families and create an economic base for them to be able to move out of poverty. The concessions that we have to make here in the state of Oregon should not be made on the backs of poor families in this state. A family that's working full-time should not be living in poverty and should not have to make the choice of heat or eat, medical coverage or rent, transportation to work, or child care. I really want to see the voice of the voters in this state stand. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Cassandra?
I'm Tyra Lynn.
Excuse me. This is Tyra Lynn.
I am a child care provider. I work for minimum wage. I am that voice that is telling you I cannot survive on the minimum wage without the increases. I struggle every month to pay my bills, to find child care that I can afford. I lost a job last August not because of minimum wage increases, but because I could not pay for child care for the hours I did have to work. It's a constant struggle. I just cannot emphasize that we are not making it on what it is now. I cannot emphasize enough that it has to go up. It must go up. About job creation at less of a wage, again, we're not surviving on what we're making now. I am still on food stamps. I take my children to the park and I dig in the trash cans for bottles and cans so that I can afford to pay for diapers for a gallon of milk. And a gallon of milk is not something that you're going to see coming in a food box from the Oregon Food Bank. It's just not something that they have available for you. And I have two children under two that must have milk every day. It's just an endless struggle, and I'm not going to take up any more time. Thank you.
Thank you. Ramon. Welcome.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ramon Ramirez. I'm president of the Oregon Farm Worker Union, PECUN, and on behalf of our 5,000 members, we want to oppose House Bill 2624. Farm workers are America's and Oregon's lowest paid workers. A farm worker annual income is $7,500 a year. And real wages paid to farm workers have not increased in years. Therefore, you know, we are in opposition to the elimination of the indexing. We feel that if you factor in the cost of living, you know, farm worker wages have actually decreased over the year because, you know, we don't pay for the same loaf of bread the same price for gasoline that we did for last year or the year before that, and yet farm worker wages haven't increased. I also want to point out for the record is that even though farm workers are by law have to be paid by minimum wage, $6.90, I also want to report that that farm worker wages, minimum wage wages, are for those that work under piece rate, there's just like wholesale violations of minimum wage laws. During some portion of the year, most farm workers pick berries and tree fruit, and those workers are paid by a piece rate, or they're just paid for what they're picked, right? And although growers claim that farm workers average well above minimum wage per hour in piece rate earning, I want to point out that few farm workers working under piece rate actually reach actually make more than the minimum wage. In fact, in a survey that we conducted about 10 years ago, we found that 50% of the farm workers did not make minimum wage on the average day, and 95% of those workers that we interviewed failed to make minimum wage on one day or more during the harvest season. The wholesale violation of minimum wage law through piece rate system endures because enforcement is virtually non-existent. And in fact, we would advocate for more funding for the Bureau of Labor and Industries to enforce minimum wage rather than eliminating the indexing. We think that that at least 98% of the actual minimum wage violations in piece rate do not go unclaimed because, you know, there's just virtually non-enforcement, there's fear of retaliation and so forth. And so what I wanted to do is give up the rest of my time to invite Jose de Jesus, a farm worker, to give testimony if he can. For that, I want to call him up.
Okay, you have 2 minutes.
Yeah.
Is this Jose?
Right.
Okay.
So in conclusion, I just want to say that I think it would, you know, we stand in opposition to eliminating the indexing, and we think that that farm worker wages need to be respected. We know that it's not the $6.90 and in the following years, whatever increases will come is not a living wage for farm workers, but at least we should be guaranteed that. Yes.
Hola, me llamo José de Jesús Barajas.
My name is José de Jesús Barajas.
Soy campesino y vivo en Salem.
I'm a farm worker and I live in Salem.
Yo creo que en el asunto del sueldo mínimo hay varios problemas.
I think there are a lot of problems around the issue of the minimum wage.
Uno es que cuando sube el sueldo mínimo, incluso cuando no sube, todo lo demás sube también, hasta que casi no le alcanza a uno para pagar sus cuentas y sus necesidades.
When is that? When the minimum wage goes up, as well as when it doesn't, everything else goes up as well, to the point at which one is barely able to pay the bills and needs.
Donde quiera las cosas están subiendo, en particularmente las rentas y la gasolina.
Prices are going up everywhere, especially rent and gasoline.
Desde mi perspectiva está bien que el sueldo mínimo suba cada año.
From my perspective, it is good that the minimum wage rises each year.
Si se si se queda estancado el en 690, las cosas se ponen muy difíciles.
If it stagnates at $6.90 an hour, things become very difficult.
Uno hace sus pagos y luego se queda sin nada.
One pays bills and ends up with nothing.
También está bien que subió porque a 6.50 ya no era suficiente. Ya era un sueldo muy barato después de 4 años.
It is also good that the minimum wage went up this year because at $6.50 an hour, it was no longer sufficient. After 4 years, it wound up being a very cheap wage.
Cuando yo trabajé en los fertilizantes, ganaba a 7 la hora. Era...
When I worked in fertilizers, I earned $7 an hour.
Era muy duro el trabajo y los trabajaba 40 horas cada semana. A veces parecía que trabajaba 80.
The work was very hard, and the 40 hours per week that I worked sometimes felt like 80 hours.
Excuse me, we are out of time, so if you, I'll give you a few minutes just to finish up if you could.
Yo creo que el sueldo mínimo tiene que seguir subiendo cada año y que es importante que la legislatura vea cómo es la situación para los que ganamos el sueldo mínimo.
I believe that the minimum wage must continue to rise each year, and that it is important that the legislators see what the situation is like for those who earn a minimum wage.
Creo que es necesario tener un sueldo mínimo de por lo menos $8 por hora.
I believe that it is necessary to have a minimum wage of at least $8 an hour.
Thank you very much for your testimony. I appreciate it. Okay, our next panel will be Bob Schaefer, Christmas Tree Grover, Paul Iverson, Iverson Family Farms, Kathy LeComp, Brooks Tree Farm. I'd also like to say that was Hector Villalobos, the interpreter at the Capitol here. Good morning.
Morning, Chairman Close, members of the committee. My name is Bob Schaefer, and I manage Noble Mountain Tree Farm. We're a Christmas tree farm here locally. We have 3 divisions around the Salem area. We're currently managing a little over 5,500 acres. And I'm here in support of House Bill 2624, which would delete the annual adjustment for the minimum wage. A little over 3 years ago, our company bought out 2 companies in Washington. Right after that, they did the same thing. They passed a bill raising the minimum wage and tying annual increases to the CPI. I was amazed how much those divisions' costs went up compared to Oregon's costs. And because of that, we are now in the process of relocating those 2 divisions that we bought out in Washington to Oregon. In fact, last year we had to reduce positions up there by 1 management position and 6 production positions, and we are in an ongoing process of transitioning out of Washington. Now we have the same situation in Oregon. We did some calculations after the minimum wage increase. It's going to cost our company over $107,000. This is going to come straight off the bottom line. And this is basically an entry-level and seasonal worker wages alone.
We pay a lot of overtime at time and a half, and so actually that 40 cent an hour increase translates into 60 cents an hour. And that's not factoring in the ripple effect throughout the rest of our workforce, because they've seen entry-level positions getting a 6% increase, so obviously they want the same commensurate increase. Just to give you a little bit of information about our industry, according to the Oregon Agricultural Statistics Service, a couple of weeks ago they put out a fact sheet that says that Christmas trees are now the fourth largest crop in value production at over $160 million in revenue, and over 90% of that is exported out of the state. Our company actually exports over 99% of our production out of state. There are three major growing areas in the United States. Oregon is number one, and we produce over 8 million trees. North Carolina is number two. They produce about 7 million trees. Michigan, Wisconsin are number three. They produce about 6.5 million trees. The problem for Oregon growers is that our competitive areas that we have to deal with all have state minimum wages of $5.15 an hour. If you do the math, Oregon's minimum wage is 34% higher than our other two major Christmas tree producing areas. If the minimum wage is raised annually, it's only going to improve their competitive advantage in our region. It takes 7 to 10 years to grow a Christmas tree, depending on the species. So there's significant labor costs in each tree. Our company's current workforce is about 70 people, and it grows to about 400 during harvest. With our continuing transition out of Washington to a new division here in Oregon, we had anticipated having 16 new year-round positions, or adding them to our company this year. We're not going to do this now, because besides the wages, you have health and welfare, holiday, vacation, and profit-sharing benefits that also come into play over and above the actual labor costs. Our company, we've decided, would be better served hiring temporary production workers from California in proportionate numbers once harvests have slowed down there to get our work done. This means less money spent by our company in the Salem area, and frankly, less money staying here that's going to be spent in the area. For the last 2 years, North Carolina, Michigan, and Wisconsin have targeted our major export market area, which is California, and have gained market share through lower pricing, in spite of the fact they're shipping 2 to 2.5 times as far as we are. Our company cannot raise prices as long as these regions have the competitive advantage they do with their wage rates. We used to be a major shipper to Texas. Last year we lost another major retail account to the tune of almost 40,000 trees to a North Carolina shipper who quoted under us by over $2 a stick. Because of the nature of our crop, our company has to project and plan extremely long-term, relatively speaking, 7 to 10 years. Can anyone here, based on our current statute, tell me what to plan for as an entry-level minimum wage 8 to 10 years from now? Because it's going to impact the cost of what we are planting today. My competitors in North Carolina, Michigan, and Wisconsin do not have to worry about unknown wage rates in their planning. I was at a national Christmas tree marketing conference in Carolina a little over a month ago, and talking to our grower competitors in North Carolina, Michigan, Wisconsin, they indicated that they have started increasing their plantings starting 2 years ago, and they're going to continue to plant aggressively as long as they can compete with us. Simply put, this is very scary for our company, because on our low-value farmland, we don't have options other than letting our crops grow for timber. I'd just like to see us help us, like you to help us by, in our future, by supporting this bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair, members of the committee, I want to thank you for the opportunity today to speak on House Bill 2624.
And are you Paul?
Yes, I am. My name is Paul Iverson. I live and farm in the Woodburn area with my family.
We are a second-generation farm and have been in business for over 50 years. We currently farm approximately 2,500 acres. Our crops include potatoes, green beans, sweet corn, grass seed, squash for seed, cabbage for seed, wheat, and we also raise nursery stock, tulips, and daffodils. We employ approximately 25 full-time employees, and with seasonal fluctuations going up to 150 or a few more. As you know, the economy in Oregon has faced some difficult times. Oregon agriculture has been facing difficult times for several years now. This is evident by the closures and bankruptcies of AgriPac, AgriFrozen, PickSweet, Chiquita Foods, AgriBiotech, and now Smucker's and Woodburn. We've also seen the loss of options for our crops with cheap imports from other countries. I personally have been affected by all these closures, but I've been able to adapt by changing crops and mechanizing, looking for niche crops. This issue is very emotional for me because it affects me personally, and I'm sorry if it gets to you too, but...
Take your time.
I remain competitive. To remain competitive, we've had to ways to look at ways to reduce costs. Labor is our largest overall cost. Last year, we purchased planting and harvesting equipment for tulip bulbs from Holland to become more efficient. By doing this, it eliminated several jobs. By becoming more efficient, we will be able to stay in business, but the employees we replace must now find jobs elsewhere. We have looked for niches and increased our cut flower production of tulips and daffodils. We have grown tulips and daffodils for over 30 years. To increase our niche crops, we began raising greenhouse cut flowers approximately 11 years ago. This worked well for us because we could retain employees by offering them year-round employment. To keep this simple, I will discuss only the production of our greenhouse daffodils to make my point. I use approximately 25 seasonal employees to plant, cut, and package greenhouse daffodils. We plant our daffodil bulbs in trays in October and November and then begin picking in December, January, and early February. Since these are hand-planted, picked, and packaged, labor is the largest expense. In 1996, we sold 5-stem daffodils for $1.85. This year, we are receiving $1.05 per stem, so we have taken a dramatic decrease in our price. During this time, we've seen our minimum wage increase from $4.75 an hour in 1996 to $6.90 today. Along with increased labor costs, other expenses have dramatically increased, such as our utilities, insurance, and general repairs. Because of the increased cost of our production and lower selling price, this is our last year of raising greenhouse daffodils. This will mean next year we will not be hiring these 25 additional seasonal employees in October through February. Also, we will be laying off 12 full-time staff, which we consider family. We are already talking with our employees to see what we can do to help make this transition easier. It is a hard fact of economics, but as a farmer who works side by side with my employees, it has become a personal issue. It is hard to tell someone you can no longer afford to hire them, especially after years of dedicated service. At the end of this season, we will be evaluating our greenhouse tulip production, in which we have seen same production increases and decreased returns. At this point, much depends on what is decided here in this session. Our field production of tulips and daffodils will continue for the time being. However, if current trends continue, we will be forced to eliminate these flower crops. Growers in other states are also faced with these price cost factors. In Washington State, the Skagit Valley has gone from dozens of growers to only three. We find most of our competition does not come from other states, but is international. It is from Canada. We cannot pass our increased costs along. We are competing in a global market. The Willamette Valley has long been known for its diversity and quality of crops. In the global marketplace we compete today, quality has taken a backseat to price. I realize that I am not a large grower, but the loss of any jobs at this time creates an impact on our local economy. The effect is even more devastating for the employees that will have to try and find another job. Because of this, I would encourage you to support House Bill 2624. Thank you.
Thank you. And Kathy.
Chairman Close, my name is Kathy LeConte. My husband and I operate a wholesale nursery in Seon, just north of town here. The nursery industry in Oregon has been a shining star in agriculture. While most of agriculture here in food crop production has struggled, the nursery industry has brought in $700 million in the last recent survey, and 80% of that is shipped out of state. That's where well over half $1 billion of new out-of-state dollars coming in to support Oregon's economy. Success stories like that don't escape the view of these other farmers that are having such a hard time. As the ability of farmers in other foreign countries increase, as farmers in other countries increase in their ability to ship their crops around the nation, the farmers here in the United States have had an increasingly difficult time. I have a friend who told me that he grows 21 crops. If you count nursery crop as one and Christmas trees as one, he grows 19 other crops. Every one of those 19 other crops is currently losing money. He's not the only person to see that Christmas trees and nursery stock are the only crops currently making money here in Oregon. And more of those farmers are going out of business and going into the nursery business. That greatly concerns us. Although we've been the shining star, the only profitable, or one of the very few profitable commodities here in Oregon, we can't continue to absorb all the other farmers that need to go out of business because they can no longer compete in a global market. Additionally, our crops are shipped to the high population centers in the eastern part of the United States. When we ship a truckload of 1 gallon containers, that's 8,000 containers that need to go into that truck. Cost approximately $4,000 to ship that truck from Oregon to New York. We've been able to do that in the past and been able to compete well because we live in a mild climate with abundant rainfall and we've been able to produce high quality plants. The growers in other parts of the United States are beginning to learn from us. They're improving their production methods. They're learning how to fertilize better. And they're beginning to do things like retractable roof greenhouses, where they're able to compete with us. They're able to mimic our climate here and compete with us very well. They're much closer. While farmers in New Jersey and the Carolinas are able to provide smaller quantity minimums and produce reasonable quality crops, they can ship freight free for up to 150 miles. We can't compete with that. I would like for you, in conclusion, I know we're short on time today, I would like for you, as you move forward on this bill, to ask yourselves, what do you want for Oregon? Do you want to continue to drive food crops out of production here in Oregon? Do you want agriculture in general to continue to decline? When the Northwest Forest Plan came to Oregon, concern that the timber jobs would go out of existence. I think we can look around now and see that those high-paying jobs and the taxes that they paid, the timber tax that went to support the schools, would probably come in pretty handy right now. And unfortunately, we don't want to see that go on in agriculture also. I'd encourage you to support this bill.
Thank you, panel. You have left time for questions. We have... Oh, I'm 2 minutes. Okay, but this panel still has time, right?
Yeah. Maybe
how much time on this panel?
15 minutes for this
group. Oh, the whole group. I'm sorry. Okay, we have another group. Sorry. There is no time for questions. Thank you so much. Dan Floyd, Billy Townsend, Bill Olson. And you have 15 minutes. So, hit the road running. Welcome.
Trustee?
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, members of the committee, for this opportunity to speak to you. I am Phil Olson. I am a co-owner of Calix Fruit Company. I'm a 30-year farmer here in the Willamette Valley. I've been forced into the food processing industry because of the massive closures of fruit processing plants in the Willamette Valley. The list of food processors who have affected our operation since inception or producing fruit beginning in the 70s include names and regions such as Forest Grove, Sunset Packing, Flavorland Foods, Salem's, Del Monte, Kelly Farquhar, Delegate Foods, AgriPac, and of course the recent closure up north in Woodburn of Smucker's. What's happening with these companies is that obviously there is just no money to be made for the risk taken in fruit production. In 1998, I was forced to begin processing and our own blueberries. As a processor chose to just close their doors, the plant was unsaleable. They closed their doors and left no opportunity for me to handle my fruit that originates from our farms. We do our cash buyer of fruit as well. Because there's no processing plants with the capacity that would handle what we do. So we were forced to take that next level of operation and enter the fruit processing. We're a small processor. We require about 100 employees during our 6 to 8 week season. We have one singular employee for the balance of the year. The vast bulk of our employees are entry-level line workers. As was pointed out by Bob Schaefer earlier, our competition is not across the street or not within Oregon. Our competition is primarily in Michigan, which is the large growing area for blueberries in the United States. Michigan's wage, and I confirm this in phone calls, is $5.15 an hour, which puts us, as he pointed out, 33-34% higher wages. A blueberry is a commodity. I like to think our blueberries are better than anybody else's. I'm a red-blooded Oregonian, and I'd like to say that we do a better job than anybody else. But the fact of the matter is, when you're dealing with the Krogers and the Walmarts and the people around the world, one handful of my blueberries looks very similar to another handful of blueberries. So we cannot change our pricing whatsoever, regardless of our costing. I think it's not only unfair to operate on an unlevel field, but the very fact that other people have chosen to leave the food processing industry means that I hope I can last there for a little while, and the only reason I'm there, my life was much more comfortable when I was able to sell to a processor. But we are left really with no other choice as to eliminate workers. We've been operating our food processing plants since 1998. Our first major purchase was an optical sorting machine. Technology is getting better and better. This optical sorter allowed us to displace a number of workers on our lines. And as we go get more technology, the goal would be to obviously compete with these other areas. I like my employees. They're good friends of mine, a good share of them. But we will really be forced to do nothing else other than look for ways to reduce our labor supply, our labor costing. We cannot control our freezing costs. We cannot control. There are very, very few things that we can control, and we absolutely cannot explain to our customers that we need more money because our costs are high. They smile a little bit. I've heard a little bit about we got to keep up our cost of living. If you'd like to talk to what it is in agriculture to keep up with cost of living, those of us in agriculture will not understand that, what a cost of living is, because the only way to do it is by efficiencies and increasing our productivity. The barometer of a healthy industry, I think we really need to take a look at, is measured by the amount of new capital entering that industry. You can look at the food processing industry, and I hope it's not a surprise to any of you on this committee that there are fewer and fewer players every year. Oregon's food processing industry is sick. There's no question about it. The massive bankruptcies right here in Salem with AgriPac and other large, large names is really directly related to obviously a cost issue, and certainly labor is one of those costs. One thing people think of, we talk about the living wages, and I think everyone, that would be nice if we can assure that. There are farmers that do not enjoy that every year. We're in it for competition and for independence and a bunch of other reasons. What really happens is there's only so much in my pie that I have. I can cut that pie up only so many ways. And what happens is I've had to have conversations with some of my more long-term workers and said what's happened on this minimum wage issue is that now I cannot offer you those kinds of growth that you would expect because I cannot pass those costs on. And so it has a little bit of a negative. One wonders why they would stay with an industry as of mine when we're not able to offer wage growth like we would like to be able to. To have a wage keyed to a automatic inflator, to me, looks very, very similar, like something like tying a PERS retirement to an 8% automatic growth. I don't understand that. Now, just looking from the outside, I don't have the difficult decisions you folks do on trying to balance a budget. That in some respects might have been because that we made some guesses on things that we were not able to come up with. And some very, very difficult decisions have to be made. And I don't relish your positions in doing that, but I would like to thank you for your time in doing that. It's the same thing with us. As Mr. Schaefer pointed out, what's going to happen to us on this? To someone tell me that I have to pay more because of a cost of living increase in Portland with absolutely zero consideration, none, for my ability to pay. I just don't get it. If one thinks that we ought to have that, then one should continue to possibly guarantee 8% on our state retirees' PERS benefits. That's not a real loud voice doing that. Similar thought. So in closing, I would really like to have you give your support to House Bill 2624 to allow Oregon's processing industry to have at least a very small chance to prevail. And I thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
All right.
You have about 7 minutes.
7 minutes. Thank you. My name is Billy Townsend, and I am here today to fill in for Mike Townsend and represent Townsend Farms in the support of the passage of House Bill 2624. Mike and Jeff Townsend joined the business in 1975. Townsend then started processing berries as well as growing them. Today, Townsend Farms is one of the largest berry growers in the state of Oregon, with currently over 1,000 acres in production. It is also one of the largest agricultural employers in the state as well. Townsend seasonally houses approximately 800 farm laborers to work in its fields and to work in its processing facilities. Our projected payroll dollars this year will exceed $10 million. And this is where our greatest concern lies, because the majority of our workforce are minimum wage workers who depend on us for their livelihood. The recently passed minimum wage, which is tied to the Consumer Price Index, is going to force us to look at eliminating as many jobs as possible and automating wherever we can to survive in the competitive climate that we operate in. Recently published CPI increases by Globalize Incorporated indicate that minimum wage may be anywhere from $8.95 to $9.35 an hour by the year 2013. If these figures hold true, that puts our industry in a position of not being competitive, which will mean a loss of jobs and tax revenue for the state of Oregon. If you take a look at Oregon and Washington today, you will find that they are one of the only two states in the nation with a CPI tied to minimum wage. Oregon at number 3, Washington at number 2, have also two of the highest unemployment rates in the nation. I wonder why. Unless the legislature has the wherewithal to pass a proposed House Bill 2624, which deletes the annual adjustment of minimum wage, the Oregon agricultural industry, along with other segments of industry in Oregon, will be irrecoverably damaged. You know, I don't claim to have all the answers, and I don't pretend to either, but I've been in this industry long enough to know that pegging agriculture to indexes that are based on market forces in the largest urban centers in the U.S. is a definite mismatch. Oregon over the last 5 to 10 years has seen various agricultural companies that have either gone broke or that have either chose to go out of business and just relocate because of simple economic factors. Conroy Packing, Chiquita, AgriFrozen, AgriPack, as mentioned before, Flavorland Foods, Carriage House, Claremont West, and soon to be Smucker's, you guys. This is major job loss. Major tax dollars lost here for the state of Oregon. This is serious business. Okay, because of the competitive nature of our industry, we're forced to operate in margins that don't absorb these kinds of increased costs for us to compete in a viable marketplace. And just like Mr. Iverson said, this is very emotional because we're a family business. We operate tight and lean. You got myself and my father beating down doors every day to sell the fruit. We don't have a huge and expensive payroll for management. We do the best we can. These people have been with our family for years. And, you know, this is just, it's hard to stomach. This year alone, we're going to be faced with increased labor costs of over $500,000. If subsequent years, in subsequent years, if the CPI holds true to projections, we'll be faced with an increase of up to $200,000 or more every year thereafter. You know, I guess in summary of this whole thing, from $650 to $690, when minimum wage rose from $650 to $690, that might not be the final nail in the coffin for the agricultural industry. But tying it to the CPI certainly will. You know, it's preposterous to think that consumer products will keep pace with the consumer price index. It never has in the past, and I doubt it ever will in the future. And that's all.
Thank you so much. Appreciate
Thank you.
Dan.
I'm Dan Floyd. I'm representing the Oregon Grocery Association, our 300 members, and over 40,000 employees that are industry employees. In order to keep from repeating what my colleagues have already said to you today, I would just like to run down a list of retailers that I've brought to you. These are 10 retailers throughout the state of Oregon who own 40 grocery stores. And I want to show you what they've been forced to do in response to Measure 25. The list should be in front of you if you want to follow along. JC Select Market. Does everybody have a copy? JC Select Market is run by Jim Young. It's in Junction City. He has two stores. Due to Measure 25, he has been forced to cut labor hours by 16.25%, or 320 hours to 268 hours per week. He is considering moving his business to another state. Moving down the list, Dean Kegler. He has two stores in Boardman. That's in Morrow County, the county with the second highest unemployment rate in the state, at 10.8% currently. He has only made three part-time positions as of right now. He's also looking to close a store in Boardman right now. C&K Markets, owned by Doug Nyfer, he has 29 stores, Southern Oregon, Central Oregon, and all throughout the Oregon coast. He typically will hire 50 full-time seasonal jobs in the summer. He has informed me that this summer he will not hire any of those 50 positions. It's 50 jobs lost. Newport Avenue. Newport Avenue Market, owned by Rudy Dory, it's in Bend, Oregon. He has one store. He's cutting 25 labor hours per week. But what was more important to Rudy when I talked to him was that he explained to me the ripple effect on him. He wants to maintain the level, the difference in pay between his minimum wage employees and his employees that have been with him longer. To do this, he has raised costs by $42,000 in 2003. And I talked to five Century stores. They are in Burns, Redmond, Affine, Prineville, and Bend. These five stores combined will cut labor hours by 107 hours per, or I'm sorry, they've already cut labor hours by 107 hours per week and also eliminate two full-time positions and two part-time positions. The store in Burns is going to consider closing. Finally, we're moving on. Michael Sturfwell, that's in Roseburg, Oregon, has cut 36 hours per week, 36 labor hours, that is, which is just less than one full-time position. And finally, Ron Brake, Food for Less owner in Portland and Gresham, obviously has two stores. Sorry, this is a unique example because Ron has always paid above the minimum wage. Until the last hike in minimum wage, he's been a dollar above. Now, he's at $7.50 an hour right now, provides benefits and health care and a 401k. He wants to maintain this level. And to maintain this level, as of right now, he's cut 15 hours a week from full-time employees and cut 5 part-time positions.
Okay, and we are at time, so I'll give you one more minute to close.
Okay, well, I'll just move on to the conclusion. I've provided from our retailers, 10 retailers, 40 stores, they're all cutting hours. They're all cutting jobs, which is a direct effect of Measure 25. This explains how Measure 25 has failed, and I urge you to vote to support House Bill 2624.
Thank you very much. Thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate it. Okay, we will go to our last 30-minute panel. We have run over slightly. We wanted to allow time for the interpreter. So we will call forward Jeff Thompson, Senator Tony Corcoran. Is Senator Corcoran here? Reverend Dan Bryant and Ellen Lowe. And you may go ahead and start.
All right. Good morning, Madam Chair, Committee. Thank you for having me here today. My name is Jeff Thompson. I am a policy analyst and labor economist with the Oregon Center for Public Policy. Since our time is short, I will keep my comments brief and comment on two general aspects of this bill, House Bill 2624, which would remove the inflation adjustment provision that was passed by voters in Measure 25. On the issue of the appropriateness of the particular inflation measure that was included in Measure 25, there has already been testimony by Dan Gardner as to the broadness of the particular measure, the US CPI, covering the broadest base of workers and the population in the country. This particular index is actually recommended by the Bureau of Labor Statistics for use in local wage escalator clauses precisely for that reason, because it's the least volatile price index that the country has. But around the debate around Measure 25, there were some questions raised as to how appropriate is this particular measure for Oregon, how appropriate is it for rural Oregon, how appropriate is it for agriculture in Oregon. And the testimony that I've handed in is actually a copy of a report that we completed last month addressing these same issues. First of all, an important point to realize is that most farm workers in Oregon work and live in urban areas. The estimates, depending on which data that you use, are anywhere between 60% and 70%. The figure that we use and rely on in the report is a little over 60%, 62% live in the urban areas along the I-5 corridor. The Employment Department has a slightly higher figure. Nearly 70% of farm workers work in the Portland and Willamette Valley urban areas. And these are the very areas that the price indexes are, in fact, drawn from. And another important point to remember regarding the use of a particular price index is that the use of the US CPI is actually should be considered quite conservative. Looking back over the last 10 years, when we track prices and look at prices as they have increased in the Portland-Salem area, we see that they've risen 30%. Looking at the US CPI instead, the index, the measure that's used in Measure 25, we see that prices rose only 26%. So right out of the gates, we're adopting an inflation measure that apparently considerably understates the actual inflation that workers in the Portland area and most agricultural workers will face. Does the US CPIU overstate inflation as it might be experienced in rural areas? Well, probably not. There is a subset of the US CPIU which focuses exclusively on small cities, those cities having populations under 50,000. And the inflation between 1992 and 2001 was also 26%, identical to the level of inflation seen at the national level.
Excuse me. We'll welcome Senator Corcoran forward, and please continue.
Sure. And we also have to remember that there is no measure of rural inflation. So even if we did want to adopt the principle of establishing differential increases in the minimum wage based on geography, there simply is no such measure of rural inflation that exists to do such a thing. I want to move on to addressing some comments to the issue around the impact of minimum wage increases on jobs. I think that Professor Ruffalo did a fine job of laying out the basic situation regarding research and economics on the minimum wage. The reality is that some studies show an impact on jobs by increasing the minimum wage. Many other studies show no impact whatsoever. Some studies even actually show increases in employment due to minimum wage increases. I think that a colleague of mine, an economist, Jared Bernstein, with the Economic Policy Institute, summed up the state of the debate quite nicely, where he said, I think it is fair to say that the debate over the purported job loss effect is a debate over whether the effect is slightly below zero or at zero. While this debate may be an important one among statistical economists, from the perspective of policymakers who are looking for ways to help the working poor, it is a distinction without a difference. Even if you were to accept the most negative findings from this research, you simply could not avoid the conclusion that the benefits of the increase far outweigh the costs. And I wanted to spend a moment here on one specific study, because there are results jumping all around the board. Most of the recent research seems to center around zero or very small, but there was a recent study looking specifically at Oregon, which was quoted in earlier testimony, which indicated that the past increase in Oregon's minimum wage caused 3% job loss in the restaurant industry. And in the range of existing research, that actually falls fairly low towards the end of the estimates. And in fact, the authors of that study go out and state that their results confirm prior findings that the employment effects of the minimum wages are small. And an important point to remember here is that the research by two economists at the University of Oregon didn't show that the minimum wage caused jobs to be reduced. What the findings actually show is that there would have been more jobs in the absence of the minimum wage. And how this can be reflected is essentially the results depend on a comparison between Oregon and Washington. And what the study looks like is that as Washington's economy continued to grow in the late 1990s, restaurants continued to grow along with the rest of the economy. So the restaurant share of jobs in Washington State continued to climb. So it maintained a constant share, jobs continuing to climb. In Oregon, restaurants actually, their share of jobs in the rest of the state declined. So there was a little bit of a drop-off, even though the number of jobs did not decrease. So its share decreased. And I introduce this technical point not to be obtuse, but simply to say that what you see is a little bit of a pattern. In Oregon, there's a nice sloping hill. In the mid-1990s, restaurant share of jobs rises and then falls after the minimum wage. In Washington, it rises and it stays flat. Well, the gap there is why that study gets those results of job losses because of the minimum wage increase. The problem, however, is that if you switch the comparison state, looking not at Washington, but looking at nearly every other state, many other states which are better comparisons for Oregon's economy, you'll find that most other states experience a similar pattern as Oregon. Employment share of restaurants rising in the mid-1990s, declining in the late 1990s. The reason for this is not because of minimum wage impacts, but it's because employment in the restaurant industry tends to be cyclical. When the economy is down, restaurants have an easier job hiring workers that otherwise would have gone to higher paying jobs when the economy was good. So you see this perverse effect that in some of the more anecdotal testimony, or more anecdotal evidence from that period. In the late 1990s, when supposed job losses are supposed to be happening in this industry, you consistently have restaurants clamoring for workers. Towards the end of 1999, there was a story in the Oregonian which summed up the situation in restaurants, and it said, if Oregon restaurants collectively craved one thing, they would clasp their hands in prayer for a few good workers to staff bustling kitchens and serving jam-packed dining rooms. They consistently reported difficulty hiring and attracting and keeping workers on. This is in a period of rapid economic growth. They're losing to workers to other industries that have more opportunities for advancement, that have higher pay, that are able to offer benefits more than they did. And now that the economy has turned soft, the counter-cyclical nature of employment in restaurant industries has reasserted itself. And now restaurants are one of the more stronger growing sectors in the state. Over the last year, the most recent figures suggest that restaurant employment has risen by 1,400 jobs. That accounts for 14% of all growth in the state, where restaurants only account for 7% of all jobs, growing considerably faster than other industries. And what's more, the research looking at employment in the restaurant industry seems to draw an equation between loss of restaurants' inability to hire people and loss of jobs. And it's important to recognize that that is not the case. To find impacts of a minimum wage increase on jobs, you do have something of a canary in the mine shaft, and those are poorly educated workers with little education. We did a report a couple of years ago that looked precisely at this population, looking at taking into account a couple of years after the fully phased-in impacts of the 1996 increase, and found that the employment prospects, the employment rate of young workers, 16 to 24, with less than a college degree, this population of workers, their employment prospects actually increased following the minimum wage. So they were not losing jobs. They were able to find jobs, and the canary in the mine shaft continues to sing despite the minimum wage and continues to have good employment opportunities. I will close by drawing the committee's attention to try to take into perspective, to the extent that we can, the sizes of the increases that we're talking about. The typical wage share of a typical restaurant's cost is 34%, and that's a nationwide figure, and someone testified earlier, gave their figure for their individual restaurant, as I think 36 or 38%. So these results will typically hold. So if you have a 6% increase in the minimum wage, and the wages represent about a third of your total costs, if that minimum wage increase fully affects all workers, which is an extreme assumption, then it will increase the restaurant's total cost by 2%. However, not all workers are impacted. So that similar increase, a 6% increase, which we had between just this last January, would impact restaurant costs of 1%. Now, looking toward the future, inflation is projected to run between 2 and 3%. 2 and 3% inflation, if half of workers are impacted, which is a reasonable and probably conservative expectation, would translate into 0.5% of a restaurant's total costs. Now, research by the Economic Research System at the Department of Labor has found that a 50-cent increase in the minimum wage, if fully passed through onto consumers, will increase costs of restaurants by 1%. What do these costs mean in relationship to price increases we've actually seen? Well, we have price evidence in Oregon in recent years that indicates that restaurants should be able to recoup most of the costs through prices. In recent years, prices at restaurants have risen 3% per year between 1997 and 2001. And following the last increase, we did see actually a spike in restaurant prices, so they were able to some degree, shift costs onto consumers and avoid employment costs. And I'll go ahead and stop now.
Thank you very much. Senator Corcoran.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I am here in opposition to the bill. And more importantly, I would like to make a process point, and that is, having read the comments in the Statesman Journal yesterday about the busy schedule of the House, I would like to remind the members of the committee that Oregon now ranks second in the nation in number of unemployed. 25,000 Oregonians have already exhausted their benefits, and we're seeing approximately 1,900 exhausting their unemployment benefits every month as we go along. So this is no time to be fiddling while Rome is burning. I think that in terms of economic development, instead of having a debate on a bill that is probably dead in the Senate and probably dead at the governor's desk, I would be very much concerned that the House follow the Senate lead and suspend their rules and move Senate Bill 2 out immediately so we can get some unemployment relief from these workers instead of beating this particular dead horse that the voters voted in. So on March 6th, now 2 weeks ago, the Senate suspended rules and passed Senate Bill 2 over here. We could have had that bill done with a suspension of the rules in the House on March 7th and signed by the governor that date and could have started the unemployment benefits. So
Senator,
really
we're
urge
not discussing Senate Bill 2. We're discussing discussing House Bill 2624.
I
have stated my reasons, so I would appreciate if you would give testimony on this bill.
I did. You heard what I had said. I hope you guys get with it. I think we're an embarrassment to the public at large. Thank you.
Thank you. On to Reverend Dan Bryant. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair Close and members of the committee. Appreciate very much the opportunity to testify against House Bill 2624. I represent the Public Policy Advocacy Committee of Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon and speak on behalf of the Board of Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon. I also pastor a congregation in the heart of Eugene where we have a significant ministry to low-income citizens of our community. These are difficult issues, and we've heard much of emotional testimony today, and it saddens me that we are pitting the interests of small family-owned businesses against those of our lowest wage income workers of this state. And I just want to note, I buy Oregon products. I hope everyone here buys Oregon products, and that needs to be our number one priority in supporting our local businesses. The best argument I can give against this bill actually was stated by the sponsor, Representative Garrard, when a delegation met with him last week from the Interfaith Advocacy Day, and he told us as a businessman that if he raised prices in small increments each year, his customers did not object, but if he held prices steady for several years and then raised them at a large increment all at once, then he would lose business, and that's precisely what we have here. The arguments cited in support of this bill are actually good arguments in favor, in that the recent increase in the minimum wage from Measure 25 was a large increase precisely because we had not had an increase in the last 4 years, and that is why we are having the problem today. If we had small incremental increases every year, problem would be distributed over the 4 years. We would not be in this kind of situation. If we pass this kind of legislation, we will be back into the same boat 3-4 years down the road when workers rebel, and we will once again raise minimum wage by a large amount, and again it will create a problem for employers. That's precisely why we need indexing. The second reason I believe you should oppose this bill is simply because it contradicts the desires of Oregon voters. Over and over again, I've heard in this building that we cannot do this or that because the voters have expressed their desires and we don't want to go against the interests of voters. Well, the voters have clearly told us what their desires are on this issue, and so I urge you to stick with that and not to repeal what the voters have just told us that they desire, and that is indexing precisely for the reasons cited. But the primary reason I ask you to reject this measure is that the bill lays the greatest burden for our current economic difficulties on those who can least afford it. Even at $6.90 an hour, the minimum wage today is only half the wage needed for a small family to support themselves. The actual cost of living for a head of household and a family of four in the urban areas is over $15 an hour. In rural areas, it's closer to $14 an hour. Removing the indexing provisions established by Measure 25 will not guarantee the creation of any jobs, but it will guarantee the continued decline of the effective wage of our lowest income workers. If we remove the minimum wage index, thousands of low-income workers will be made to sacrifice their meager increases to benefit very few, primarily those who employ them. In this time when social services are being cut left and right and hunger in Oregon remains at an all-time high, it makes no sense to freeze minimum wage at current levels. 70% of the people who are living in poverty in Oregon are the so-called working poor. They have full-time jobs but are still unable to make ends meet. We heard dramatic testimony today from two of those workers. Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon strongly supported the minimum wage provisions of Measure 25 and is therefore strongly opposed to this bill. Our social principles state the principle of justice requires that we establish social systems which encourage, enable, and empower people to fully develop and use their capabilities to meet their personal needs and to contribute to the social welfare. Most people who work in minimum wage jobs typically do not have too many economic opportunities or choices. They do so out of survival or necessity. Justice is more than charity. Justice is providing good wages so that our working Oregonians can live in dignity. The current minimum wage law, as established by voters in Measure 25, is the absolute minimum of what we must do for those who earn the lowest wage but are often among some of the hardest and most deserving workers. The indexing provisions of the minimum wage law are a fair and reasonable means to protect the wages of the working poor from the effects of inflation. Removing those provisions would do these workers an enormous injustice. So I urge you to stop HB 2624 from going any further. Thank you for this time.
Thank you. And it's Ellen Lowe. Welcome. We have 12 minutes.
Thank you, Chair Close and members of the committee. I'm Ellen Lowe, and I serve as a legislative advocate for the low-income Oregonians who have the Oregon Law Center as charged to serve them. I'd like to go back a little bit with my personal history with the minimum wage, and I went to my button collection this morning, and you can see 15 years of buttons related to the minimum wage. In 1988, I and Terry Rogers, who was then with the Law Center, we convened a group that was called the Minimum Wage Coalition. We met every Monday morning at 7 a.m., because that was a time where no one had a conflict, and worked for a whole year to put together the legislation that became law in 1989, Senate Bill 335, under the sponsorship of Senator Jim Hill. And it was representative democracy at its best. We had a number of hearings, a number of work sessions, and we gained through the legislative process an increase from $3.35 to $4.75 in Oregon's minimum wage. Now, I was probably a little naive about the process at that time, because we were able to make it work within the legislative session. And so I anticipated that in future sessions we would make adjustments. You'll see some pins relating to defending the minimum wage. That's the kind of thing we began to face then within the session. So in 96, Oregonians once again faced an initiative dealing with economic conditions in Oregon. And we had the bill then, the initiative, which had us go from $4.75 in increments for increasing the minimum wage. It wasn't the choice of us who had been part of the minimum wage coalition to have to do it this way. We had no choice. And so we then were forced to play catch up. And you heard some discussion today where we went to $5.50, and then we went to $6, and then we went to $6.50. I have very vivid recollections of the kind of criticisms we received because of the amount of the jump in the increase in the minimum wage. And so reflecting on that, I look at the vice chair of this committee, Representative Rosenbaum, and I recall that in the last legislative session there was a bill that then would have called for responding to those kinds of criticisms and would have introduced indexing into the minimum wage for the state of Oregon. Didn't receive a work session. So once again, we were unable to experience what I would characterize as representative democracy, and we had to go to the ballot. And so Oregonians then were given the opportunity at this last election once again to have us play catch-up. But hopefully, unless someday Oregonians are going to be given the opportunity to really support a livable wage, this should be the last time then that we should have to have an initiative. I went to the voters' pamphlet, because there have been some expressions that Oregonians were really not aware of the indexing. You will find that in 8 of the 13 arguments in favor, there was very explicit language about the reasons for going to the indexing. You go to the explanatory statement, again, it's very explicit. And perhaps the most explicit language was actually in the ballot title itself. And so we would suggest that really in respecting indexing, you're not only supporting an informed vote, but what you really are doing is also supporting the hospitality industry, the agricultural industry, those parts of Oregon that since I was first involved, and it's probably before that, began to ask that the minimum wage be adjusted gradually rather than in significant jumps, so it would give them an opportunity to really have their business plans planned in advance. I encourage you to reject this particular House bill and others that may be following. I do believe that Oregonians were informed in their vote, and once again, honoring the workers who often are put in a position of providing our most personal and essential services. Thank you.
Thank you, panel. We have 5 minutes left, so I'll call Joseph McKinney, Andy Seltz, Thomas Risser. Welcome.
Good morning.
Go ahead and start. You have about 2 minutes each.
My name is Joseph McKinney, and I'm the president of Oregon Roads, where we originate loans based primarily on vehicles and equipment. 70% of our clients are businesses, most based in Eugene, and our volume is between $7 and $10 million a year. I'm here today to address the impact the minimum wage has in our local economy. A healthy economy requires a balance among its various economic classes. A home buyer cannot move up to a better home unless someone else is able to qualify to either purchase or rent their existing home. My clients cannot afford to trade up in vehicle unless there is a demand for their trade-in by qualified candidates. To have a healthy marketplace requires a healthy economic dynamic. My experience in finance on the local level validates the trickle-up economic model. My electrical contractors are not leasing new vans because the restaurant they just remodeled is not paying their bill because working people are not going out to eat. I've supported an increase in the minimum wage because the standards in our community are too low, and it shows. I'm not addressing the political or philosophical questions of a minimum wage. I'm looking at it as a small but necessary economic stimulus package. And when I hear how few dollars staff estimates this to cost, I say shame on us for hesitating. Ladies and gentlemen, this is chump change. Every penny that finds its way into a worker's paycheck is funneled back into our local economy, where it is spent again and again. Consumer spending stimulates business-to-business spending. It's all connected. We're all connected. That's the dynamic I'm talking about that is necessary for a healthy local economy. I respectfully suggest that you take leadership on this issue. An indexed minimum wage benefits the broad spectrum of economic classes in Oregon.
Thank you.
Chair Close, representatives, for the record, my name is Andy Saltz. I'm the Chief of Staff for the Associated Students of Oregon State University and the Vice Chair of the Oregon Student Association. Today I'm speaking in opposition to House Bill 2426 on behalf of the Oregon Student Association, which represents over 100,000 students statewide. Many of whom work in minimum wage jobs. Minimum wage jobs are essential to students who are working to attain a college education. A steady annual adjustment to the minimum wage is critical to ensuring that working students' income stays in line with their expenses. As students are facing tuition increases, increasing in living expenses, and declining financial aid, many students are forced to take on jobs, while other students are increasing their hours to cover their cost. Many of the jobs that are available to students only pay minimum wage. The gradual adjustment in minimum wage will ensure that thousands of students are able to afford the increasing cost of post-secondary education. In a time when students are being asked to shoulder their share of the current budget crisis, it is important that we protect those students who are working to put themselves through school. Affordable and accessible post-secondary education leads to an educated workforce, increased earning power, and greater opportunity for employers and employees in our state. An indexed minimum wage is a factor in maintaining affordability for those students who are dependent on minimum wage jobs to get their education. We ask that you consider those students whose education is reliant upon minimum wage jobs. Oregon voters understand the importance of a minimum wage that can support all minimum wage employees, and we ask that you uphold their decision. The Oregon Student Association urges you to vote no on House Bill 2426 and continue to allow working students to afford an education and eventually give back to our state. Protect our students. Protect the minimum wage. Thank you.
Thank you. Aaron, we have how many minutes?
One minute.
I'm sorry.
Thank you, Chair, for giving me time to talk. My name is Thomas Reiser. I'm a student senator over at Western Oregon University. I'm on honor roll. I'm spent 4 years in the Marine Corps, so I'm a veteran. I value my education. I'm on the honor roll, as I said. And I work at Red Lobster right down the street on Lancaster. I work with a lot of single mothers. I work with a lot of older people, not just kids, like the cliche would say. And these are people just like me. If I miss a shift, I don't pay rent that day. I don't pay that rent that month. I'm on shift. I work double shifts on the weekends. I have one day off. Basically, if I don't go to my Saturday or Sunday shift, I'm sick. I don't pay my garbage bill. I don't pay my electric bill. It is imperative that I get the hours that I do just to make a living. Okay, so I know we're short, and that's all I'd like to say. Thanks for giving me the time.
You have how much?
It is time.
Excellent job. Thank you, panel, very much. This concludes the testimony that has been given on this bill. We've had 27 people testify, and I thank you all for coming. I think you did an excellent job, and I think both sides were well presented. And so we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2624. And is there anything else for the good of the committee?
I'm sorry, could I just ask, because I know there was at least one person in the audience here to testify thinking that he would be able to do so today. Is there going to be another opportunity for public comment?
We're considering that, Representative Rosenbaum. We do have two other bills here on Friday, but it's possible we could have open testimony, but we have not yet made that decision. And we are adjourned.